Father's Day, otherwise known as a Rodney Dangerfield of holidays. It gets no respect, okay? It just, you know, I don't know what it is about us dads, but, you know, apparently we failed the test, all right? It just, well, I mean, because there are tests. I remember mom going out, little four-year-old daughter with her, and they're walking, and the little girl sees something on the ground and picks it up, gets ready to put it in her mouth. And mom says, "Don't do that." And the little girl looks up and says, "Why?" She goes, "Because it's been on the ground. It's got dirt and germs. It'll make you sick. You don't want to put that in stuff in your mouth." And the little girl just looks at mom like these big eyes of admiration and says, "How do you know all of this stuff?" And the mom says, "All moms know this stuff. You have to know it or else you don't get to be a mom." Oh. And if you don't pass, then you're the daddy. You see how it goes, don't you? Don't you? You know, I mean, even when dads try to do right, have you ever noticed when you try to do right, you can still mess up? All right? Mom goes out, dad's with the kids, okay? All right? Five-year-old Jack, all right? 18-month-old Sally, okay? And mom's out, dad's reading the paper, Jack's in his room playing, and Sally has this tea set, little toy tea set that she's absolutely enjoying so much. And so she comes out to dad with the cup, you know, with the water, with the tea in it, you know. And dad, of course, playing along, drinks it up. "Oh, this is great tea. Oh, this has to be the best tea. I don't think I've ever had such great tea in my," you know, plays it out. And of course, Sally's just thrilled, all right? And off she goes to make some more tea for dad, you know. And mom, you know, eventually comes home, and dad says, sit down, watch this. This is the cutest thing. You're going to love this. Watch this, you know. And sure enough, here comes Sally with the little cup of tea, you know, and dad drinks it up. "Oh, this is great tea," you know, and Sally goes and makes some more. And mom looks at dad. It just nods, shakes her head, and says, "Has it occurred to you that the only water she can reach is from the toilet?" Oh, dear. Yeah. Yeah. When you read the Bible, dads flunk the test a lot too, all right? There aren't a whole lot of good father figures here in the Bible. We look at them, and here right now we hear about Jesse, all right? Samuel is going to come to Jesse's house. Jesse, God bless him. I guess when you have that many kids, it's hard to keep up with them all, okay? So anyway, Samuel, I don't know if you know the backstory, okay? Way back, Israel's first king was Saul, okay? Tall, handsome, matinee monarch, you know, just wonderful looking guy. Except for his heart really didn't follow God, and he cursed, and he threw, you know, spears at musicians, and, you know, consulted with witches, and did all kinds. And they decided that's not really what we, you know, in a king. We need a new king. And so God tells Samuel, "Go get us a new king. Go to Bethlehem." You guys know about Bethlehem, don't you? How many of you ever heard of Bethlehem? Don't you love tests like this? See, this is a test even dads can pass. We have all heard of Bethlehem, all right? So Samuel goes to Bethlehem, and he goes to the home of Jesse. Now, Jesse's not a rich family. He's not a powerful family. He's not an influential family. He's just a middle-class peasant family with a whole lot of kids, all right? And in fact, his family, are the doors shut? Because we don't want this to get out there. His family kind of has a little shady past, okay? All right? His grandfather's ancestor, Tamar, all right, almost executed for adultery. Oh! Adultery. That's pretty serious stuff. In fact, his great-grandmother was a Canaanite prostitute. Not just the prostitute, a Canaanite. What is them? See, Canaanite, Israelite, they're not the same. Hello? She was different. Okay? And, make it even worse, you trace that tree, there's Ruth. Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite. Not an Israelite. A Moabite. Yeah, we got all these immigrants. Okay? All these immigrants are coming in. All right? We've got immigrants. And this just isn't Jesse's family. Because David is from Jesse's family. And Jesus. Jesus is from this family tree with all these immigrants in it. Somebody should build a wall. Oh, wait a minute. If you've read the story, they did. They built a wall in Jericho. Remember what happened? It fell down. Why? Because the gospel is about building bridges, connecting people, not about building walls, separating people. And what we hear in this story right now is the way in which Samuel is coming to Jesse, who is not pure. If you've ever read Harry Potter, these are not pure bloods, okay? There are mudbloods all over the place, this family tree, all right? And it's Jesse and David and even Jesus. It's written in the gospel, Gospel of Matthew chapter 1, right there in big bold print, okay? Jesus has immigrants. He's got people of disrepute in his family lineage. Because guess what? That's the way God's people are. And all of God's people get to be a part of God's family. And now Samuel is coming to Jesse and saying, your lucky day, one of your boys is going to be the next king. Ha-ha! You got to be feeling pretty good, all right? I mean, that's a good Father's Day gift. Have a prophet come in and say, one of your boys is going to be the next king. You're thinking, This is good. This is good. Line up, boys. Line them up. And who's the first one? Eliab. Why? Because he's the oldest. And we all know the oldest is the best. That's why we're first. Seriously. We're the firstborn because we're the best. All right? And what happens is Eliab comes by and he's tall. He's first. I was first. He's handsome. Seriously? You guys did that? But God said, nah. Don't look on that outward appearance. I've already, remember, Saul was tall and handsome. That didn't work out. All right, we're going in the opposite direction. Second son comes by, no. Third son comes by, no. Fourth son comes by, no. Fifth one comes. All of them are passing by, all seven sons. Seven. Because Jesse forgets he's got eight. How do you do that? It's kind of like taking the family portrait and you forget the youngest. And you don't know it until the proofs come back. I mean, you go to the mall with eight kids, you come back with seven, you're thinking, hey, seven out of eight, that's not so bad. Odds are pretty good. Jesse doesn't even know that David's not in the lineup. He doesn't even know that he's missing until Samuel says to him, do you got any other sons? He has to ask Jesse, do you have any other sons? Because none of them are it. And Jesse's like, well, let me see. One. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's out keeping the sheep. Well, you better bring them in because these guys ain't it. And that's how David gets picked. That's the way God works. That's why we're being told this story. This isn't a story about some shepherd boy who became king. This is about the fact that God chooses people that we overlook, people that we discard, people who we think is different. Anybody that we don't think count, God does think count. And God uses them in mighty and powerful ways. Some of us know what that's like. Some of us are in this story, and maybe we're guilty. Have you ever found yourself judging other people? We can do that, can't we? We judge somebody because we think of them as being different. Okay? We may not judge them by the color of their skin, but we judge them by other ways. Ever judge anybody by their education? Ever judge anybody by their political affiliation? Ever judge anybody by their financial situation? Ever judge anybody because of possibly a disability situation? We find ourselves all the time thinking about, or sometimes we discount ourselves. I've known many people who think, oh, God could never use me. Oh, I'm not. Don't tell God that he can't use you. God created you, for goodness sake. God knows exactly who you are. Called you to be who you are. Created you to be who you are. This is who God wants you to be. And then God will empower you, just as he did with David, if you're open to the movings of God's grace. That's the power of the gospel. That's the power of grace. It wasn't because David was the smartest. It wasn't because David was the strongest. It wasn't because David was the bravest. It wasn't because David was anything. He wasn't even in the room. It was because of God's grace. That's what makes the difference for all of us. For all of us. Some of you may have heard the story about the monastery. It had fallen on terrible, terrible times. At one time, big, powerful, strong. But now, only 5 monks left. The abbot and 4 other monks. All of them over the age of 70. The building is in disrepair. None of them can get on a ladder. It's all just falling apart around their ears. It's terrible. The persecutions of the 17th and 18th century, the secularism of the 19th century, has caused everybody to flee away from it. And the abbot's beside himself. He doesn't know what to do. It's a beautiful monastery, what had been, up in the beautiful woods, wonderful location, but now everything is falling apart. There is within those woods a hut. And an old rabbi used to visit that. And it was a kind of a mystical connection, because every time he would visit, the other monks would feel it, feel that presence, say, oh, the rabbi's at the hut. The rabbi's at the hut. The rabbi's at the hut. And it so happened that one summer, the rabbi was at the hut. And the abbot decided to visit him to see if he had any words of wisdom at all. Anything that could help him repair and allow the monastery again to be for the glory of God. And he knocks on the door, and the rabbi welcomes the abbot, and they sit down, and the abbot spills out his heart about how things have fallen apart. And the rabbi just shakes his head in sympathy and says, it's the same way in the city. No one comes to the synagogue anymore. No one feels the presence of the Lord anymore. They weep, they pray, and the abbot leaves and says, don't you have any words of wisdom to say? And the rabbi stops and says, I have, God has placed one phrase. I can only say it once, and it can only be repeated once. Here's the words. The Messiah is one of you. That's kind of mysterious. The abbot leaves, comes back to the monastery. The monks come. What did the rabbi say? What did the rabbi say? The abbot says the same thing. He says, I can only say it once, and it can never be repeated. The Messiah is one of you. Well, what's that supposed to mean? And they pray about it, and they think about it, and they begin to reflect about it. The Messiah is one of us? The Messiah, I wonder, it must be the abbot. He's been the abbot for generation after, he's been the abbot forever, as long as we can remember. It must be. But you know, Thomas, he's a man of light. He spends a lot of time in Scripture. It could maybe he means Thomas. Well, you can't mean Alfred. Alfred is crotchety. Alfred is just a thorn in everybody's side. Alfred, except for Alfred is right a lot. In fact, turns out that Alfred is right all the time. Maybe he does mean Alfred. Maybe he could mean Philip. I mean, Philip is so passive. almost non-existent. And yet, Philip has a way. Every time you need help, whether it's in the kitchen or in the garden, Philip always has a way of just showing up right next to you. Maybe he does mean Philip. But he couldn't mean me. It's certainly God isn't calling me. Could it? And as they ponder and pray, they begin to treat each other with extraordinary respect. After all, one of them could be the Messiah. And they themselves began to conduct themselves in a way deeply connected to God, because after all, what if God does call them to be the Messiah? And as that atmosphere continues to spread amongst themselves, it spreads around. People coming to the woods begin to feel a spiritual presence. They begin to walk the paths again. They begin to visit the garden. They even go into the chapel to begin to pray. And more people are drawn by the aurora of spirituality and connectedness, until some men begin to talk to the monks, and some of them are feeling called and led to give themselves to the Lord. And after 10 years, it's a thriving monastery filled with the light and the grace of God. So many times God will be able to use us if we give ourselves over to God. And I understand that's a difficult thing. We have to be able to trust God, to trust that God is absolutely calling us. What is God calling us to do? Are we sure that God can really use us? And you look at the Bible and you say, look at who He's used. He's used all kinds of crazy, demented people. Of course He can use you. You don't even make the list. You look at the New Testament. Who did Jesus call? Bunch of uneducated fishermen and lowlifes and sinners. You read the Bible time after time. God chooses what is weak to shame the strong. God chooses what is foolish to shame the wise. God uses people like us. David was chosen because he had a heart for God. Not a wisdom, not a strength, not an appearance. A heart for God. You say, well, how do you get that? How do you cultivate a trust for God? Do I just try? If I try real hard, will I have more faith? If I try real hard, will I have more trust? How do I cultivate a heart for God? Because sometimes, we struggle with faith. You ever find yourself struggling with trust, struggling with faith, and you're just wondering, and you say, how do I increase my faith? Suppose you were doubting Old Faithful. You know the geyser? All right, you say, I just don't know if it's really going to go off. I have doubts about it. You know, it's been doing it for a while, but how long can it last? It might be over. And so what would your advice be to a person doubting Old Faithful? You wouldn't be telling them, you just have to believe, you just have to try harder. It'd be like telling you to get taller just by thinking about it. Doesn't work. No. You would say, well, why don't you go visit Old Faithful? Why don't you spend some time with Old Faithful? Why don't you read about Old Faithful? And the more time you spend in the presence of Old Faithful, the more you realize you can depend on it and trust it. The same with God. The more time we read about God, spend time in God's presence, the more we will find that our hearts turn to God. Our faith increases, our trust increases, because we are spending more time with God. We are celebrating today Father's Day, and we are blessed to be able to claim God as our Father. And to understand that with God as our parent, God's love and God's grace is calling us and claiming us as His children. Each and every one of us. Not because we're good, not because we're perfect, not because we are without sin, but because of God's love and God's grace. And because of that, we're able to celebrate the fact that God has called us, God has claimed us, and God is empowering us to share the gospel message, to knock down the walls and build the bridges, and to let everybody know that it is the cross that connects us to God and to one another. Amen.